The first reading this morning comes from the book Against All Odds, a sociological study of several multicultural religious congregations written by three different people, Bert Christensen, Corey Edwards of our own university here in town, OSU, and Michael Emerson of Notre Dame. They are studying a particular Christian church in this particular reading called Messiah Church, which has a white or Euro-American minority and Asian and African-American majorities. The service this morning is a little different in that the readings are longer and the sermon is shorter.
One particular aspect of the church service that was frustrating to many white members was the issue of time. In the early years of the church, white members frequently complained of the lack of punctuality in the way the service was run. Typically, the service would start 5 to 10 minutes after the official starting time, and even then, most of the church would be empty, except for a few white members of the church. The church had no end time at that time, and would end anywhere between 12 and 12:45, depending on what activities went on during the service. Both Filipino and non-Filipino members joke that the church runs on Filipino time, a reference to a more relaxed view of time than typically exists among white Americans. In response to complaints from some white members, however, the elders of the church decided that the service would start at 10:30, regardless of who was present, and would try to end around noon, although they stopped short of setting an official ending time. This policy was appreciated by many of the white members, but many still complained that the service started late sometimes, ended late, and not many people were there to start worshiping at 10:30. One white person said, "I'm frustrated that the church starts late and people show up late. That's a sign of disrespect, like church isn't important." Others opined, "The service is too long. It's too casual. There's no sense of respect. People come in late, bring drinks in, put their feet up on the chairs." Because this is a religious organization where members interpret most of life through a religiously informed grid, differences in culture are often talked about in absolute terms. This phenomenon is illustrated through the debate over the way the service is timed. Time-oriented white members view the lax timing of the church service not only as inconvenient for them, but also as a sign of disrespect toward God. Likewise, those who preferred a more flexible schedule felt that rigidly timing a service was squelching the Holy Spirit. Framing this cultural issue in absolute terms raises the stakes considerably, producing more conflict and less opportunity for compromise on issues of differing cultural values. This case is interesting because white people were in the minority, both in numbers and in leadership positions. This is often not the case in interracial organizations. It appears to us that the leadership of Messiah may have taken the complaints of white members more seriously than those of other ethnic groups. This was reflected in the move toward a more rigid time structure, which was pushed for by whites more heavily than by other groups. This could be, since whites, because they are culturally dominant in the larger society and are likely to be in leadership positions in their secular professions, feel more comfortable demanding the changes they want and moving into leadership positions to make those changes. It could also be that the numerical majority group members in leadership, in this case Filipinos, are more likely to value the opinions of whites as opposed to other groups because of the culturally dominant position of whites in the larger society. As one member stated, "Since this church is in America, it should go by American standards."
The second reading is from the poet Joy Harjo, her poem A Post-Colonial Tale. Joy Harjo is a musician, a performance artist, a poet, and a member of the Muscogee Nation, a Native American tribe. Every day is a reenactment of the creation story. We emerge from dense, unspeakable material through the shimmering power of dreaming stuff. This is the first world and the last. Once we abandon ourselves for television, the box that separates the dreamer from the dreaming, it was as if we were stolen, put into a bag, carried on the back of a white man who pretends to own the earth and sky. In the sack were all the people of the world. We fought until there was a hole in the bag. Then we fell. We were not aware of falling. We were driving to work or to the mall. The children were in school learning subtraction with guns. We found ourselves somewhere near the diminishing point of civilization, not far from the trickster's bag of tricks. Everything was as we imagined it. The earth and stars, every creature and leaf imagined with us. When we fell, we were not aware of falling. We were driving to work or to the mall. The children were in school learning subtraction with guns. The imagination needs praise, as does any living thing. We are evidence of that praise. And when we laugh, we're indestructible. No story or song will translate the full impact of falling or the inverse power of rising up, rising up. Our children put down their guns when we did to imagine with us. And we imagine the shining link between the heart and the sun. We imagine tables of food for everyone. We imagine the songs. The imagination conversely illumines us, speaks with us, sings with us, dreams with us, loves us. We imagine tables of food for everyone, writes the poet Joy Harjo. We imagine the shining link between the heart and the sun. What Joy Harjo of the Muscogee Nation imagines is what Mark Bellatini of Amelian American nationality also imagines. Those simple sentences could sum the basic theology by which I try to live my life, expound my philosophy, preach my sermons, and express my love to anyone. We imagine tables of food for everyone. We imagine the shining link between the heart and the sun. Yes, the sun, the greatest preacher that ever lived. The sun which shines its light impartially, as Jesus of Galilee once reminded us, on the good and the bad alike, and on the taller and on the shorter, on men and women and children of every color and every shape, on every nation, territory, culture, district, town, wilderness. It falls upon my still hospitalized brother Robert, broken into pieces by his alcoholism, and it falls just as much on other men exactly the same age as my brother, who are powerful as panthers, lobbing tennis balls on the court with enviable grace. The light of the sun falls on Tel Aviv and Gaza with equal reliability, on Rome and Boston and Cairo and Mumbai. Oh, sure, the light may be blocked by a cloud pattern of some sort, but the sun itself always shines. It never, ever takes a break, even for a single second. And the sun never, ever singles out anyone and says, "You are better than the person next to you. You deserve my light. The other person doesn't." The sun never speaks and says, "America gets a whole table of food. Sudan gets a crumb." It never says, "The land belongs to these people and not to these people." It never says, "This small circle has rights, privileges, and health. This larger circle, however, doesn't." The sun never speaks because, as you know, the light of the sun is silent, always has been, always will be. The sun preaches by example only. It does not make pronouncements dividing the human race into the haves and the have-nots. It does not favor colors or eye shapes or cultures or any religion or any critique of religion. It simply shines on everyone. And so, with Joy Harjo, I would like to imagine my own heart linked to that impartial sun. I want to imagine that my heart might grow as impartial, as reliable, and universal in its love. Oh, I know that I will never have the advantages of the sun. After all, it dwarfs our tiny earth by a million times. I will only in my life see some very small area of the earth, no matter how lucky I am to travel here and there. My most universalistic love can only go so far. My limits are real, after all. But still, I cannot help but to want, with all of my being, to be like our exemplar star, since no rival preacher has yet provided a single reason why some creatures on this earth need to be treated with violence while others are given tender care. No authority, no religion, no political party, no economic theory, nor philosophy has ever successfully debated the sun in order to prove to me that the light is for some, not for others. No one has given me a sane reason that power should be reserved for the few and not the many. Because the sun's sermon, daily given, hourly given, is so convincing, I find that my heart also wants to shed light on all that it sees. My heart wants the brilliance of justice for one and all. No exceptions, ever. And yes, it wants justice, even knowing that we all don't agree as to what the most important justice issues are. And even though we don't have yet a convincing definition of justice so broad in its embrace that the Pope and Angela Davis will agree with it, or Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow actually share it. But my heart, unfortunately, is not linked to the sun alone. It's not just lit up by my best imagination. It's linked also, as Joy Harjo reminds us, to the mall and to the places where our children learn their subtraction with guns. My heart is linked, sadly, to the larger cultures of the world, which do indeed divide the world into them and to us. My heart has been occupied by careful teachings which find conflicting meanings in the color of skin or the shape of an eye. Joy Harjo talks about the teachings in conflict with her own Native American experience. It was as if we were stolen, she writes, put into a bag, carried on the back of a white man who pretends to own the earth and the sky. So, thus aware that our hearts can be linked both to the impartial sun of our deepest imagination and to the culture of partiality which turns from all forms of imagination, Joy Harjo offers us a suggestion. We have to praise the first and resist the second if we are to survive. In order to continue to imagine tables of food for all, Joy Harjo reminds us that the imagination which imagines exactly that needs praise, as does any living thing. And how do we learn to praise the imagination? How do we nourish it, nurture it, so that it has more reality for us, more presence than malls or guns? How do we resist malls and guns and welcome the saving imagination of tables of food for all? By fearless and constant and daily self-questioning of everything that comes out of our mouths. Not the kind of self-questioning we Unitarian Universalists usually mean when we post on our bumper stickers the phrase, question authority. I'm not talking about questioning the theology of ancient creeds or querying after the meanings of words like God or Jesus or humanity. No, I'm talking about questioning ourselves, our assumptions, questioning everything that comes out of our mouths. I offered you the longer reading this morning, the one about Messiah Church, because I think it shows clearly where we need to start with those questions. Remember, there was a conflict in the church regarding time. One cultural group, largely Filipino, had a different attitude toward punctuality than the other group did, the Euro-American or white minority. The conflict had to do with beginning and ending times and the length of the service. Each one expressed their particular approach and then tried to make it cosmic. The Euro-rooted folks assumed quite clearly that showing up late actually offended God. The Filipinos felt that the Holy Spirit was being strangled by all of this attention to punctuality. I found that insightful, personally. It made me wonder how many things I think are human are actually just my Euro culture, not something which applies to all human beings everywhere. But even more so, the conflict revealed that some groups still automatically have more authority and privilege than others. In the words of the authors of the book, Against All Odds, this case is interesting because white people were in the minority, both in numbers and in leadership positions. And this is not often the case in interracial organizations. It appears to us that the complaints of white members were taken more seriously than those of other ethnic groups. This was reflected in the move toward a more rigid time structure, which was pushed for by whites more heavily than by other groups. This could be, since whites, because they are culturally dominant in the larger society and are likely to be in leadership positions in their secular professions, feel more comfortable demanding the changes they want and moving into leadership positions to make those changes. It could also be that the numerical majority group members in leadership, in this case, Filipinos, are more likely to value the opinions of whites as opposed to other groups because of the culturally dominant position of whites in the larger society. Why are the Filipinos more likely to value the opinions of whites? Because the idea that whites rule the roost lives inside of them. It's occupied them like an invading army. The white people in the congregation are not trying to oppress their fellow parishioners. Nothing of the kind. But the Filipinos have learned to oppress themselves by having this image of bowing to white authority moving around inside of them unquestioned. Internalized oppression chafes against the imagination of the heart, which can imagine tables of food for all. For example, if you happen to be a woman and you find yourself saying, "Oh, what do I have to say anyway?" you're dealing with internalized oppression. Here are some other examples I found insightful from the Rural Women's Advocacy Program. These are real things people say. Maybe you've heard them. "She was yelling at him. What did she expect but a beating? Nobody wants to be with a mouthy woman. She needs to quit being a victim. It's just another domestic fight. Traditional Indian women are subservient and quiet, you know." African American folks internalize oppression in the same way, as do Asians and Latinos and Native Americans, as do gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender folks, me included, and men of all colors are oppressing themselves when they apologize for weeping during a movie or during a wedding or when they mock themselves as being insensitive. What is oppression? It's the use of power to shove certain people to the edge of things, that is, to disempower them, or even silence them as a social group in order to empower and gain privilege for the oppressor. This means that a simple definition of internalized oppression is self-silencing. It's being embarrassed to question, being embarrassed by how one looks, the shape of an eye, the color of a skin. Too dark, too light. It's being embarrassed by how one acts. Too feminine, not feminine enough. Too heavy, too thin, too extroverted, too introverted. It's being convinced of one's inferiority, even though the sun shines on every one of you just the way it shines on everybody else. I once befriended a man named Roy out in California, who ethnically was half Spokane, which is a Native American nation in Washington state, and half African American. He was among the most handsome men I have ever laid eyes on. He had the looks of a cover model for GQ magazine. In the diverse San Francisco Bay Area where we both lived at the time, he was often praised for his looks and his completely dazzling smile. But Roy didn't grow up in that great urban center of diversity, so he had a hard time believing that praise. He grew up in rural Washington state, and he was taught something very different from early on. He was taught, carefully taught, that he was ugly. He really thought he was as ugly as a gargoyle and repulsive. Why? Because when he grew up on the Spokane reservation, he was mocked for being half black, an impure Native American. When he visited his black relatives, he was put down as merely an Indian, an impure sample of African culture. And when he attended a largely white school, he was mocked as the worst of both worlds, a creature barely human. He was beautiful and smart, Roy was. He was kind and he was strong. But Roy was among the most miserable people I have ever met because of the weed of self-hatred that grew in his heart from what had been planted there in his youth. One day he moved back to Washington. I never saw him again. But considering how much he hated himself, I don't imagine him thriving much. My plea this morning is simple. I'm asking us to regard the world around us theologically, that is, with the impartiality of sunlight. Yet to question our own assumptions about the nature of our own humanity with rigor every single day. I'm asking us to do this along the lines of our monthly theme of resistance. I'm asking us to use self-questioning as a means of resistance. There are many ways to do that in your own life. There's many ways to do it here in this congregation. There are classes like the one Susan McChrystal's leading. There's covenant groups. There's all kinds of ways of giving ourselves the freedom and the spaciousness to ask ourselves the questions that we need to ask. So that instead of allowing ourselves to be defined by the cultures of oppression around us which occupy our inner lives, we resist such definitions and learn to define ourselves. In the metaphor of the story this morning, I'm asking us to put on magic glasses, to see ourselves for what we really are, not what others think we are. I'm asking us to do all of this with the passion good parents bring to the loving of their own children. For make no bones about it, if we do not do this for ourselves, we certainly need to do it for our own children and their children, those who will inherit this world and the sunlight which illumines it after us. And thus I can only conclude my sermon with the words that Joy Harjo uses at the end of her poem. Our children put down their guns when we did. To imagine with us. We imagine the shining link between the heart and the sun. We imagine tables of food for everyone. We imagine the songs. Imagine.